and welcome to The Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. Today I want to talk to you about clowns. Not just the clowns that have been popping up around the woods of America this year, kind of people dressing up and scaring people. Indeed, even in Liverpool in the UK, we've had our own small army of people who thought it'd be hilarious to set up an Instagram feed and then go to McDonald's to dressed up as an evil clown for, I don't know, a Big Mac, I assume. You see, our obsession with frightening clowns goes back pre-cinema, indeed, although we will go into films and whatnot in a bit. The idea of a funny man who would do things that are inappropriate and improper, for example, appears in ancient Rome. There's the Archimius, who is allowed to offend even mourning families at a funeral. Sargent recounts how a person called Suetonius, in his Life of Tiberius book, describes in a funeral of Emperor Vespasian. It was his business to imitate the voice, manner, and gestures of the defunct, writes Sargent. The fellow openly cracks his jokes on the absurd expense of the funeral. Now that's an extreme example, but it feels very much like a former court jester kind of thing, like that we'd see in a European court, allowed to be rude or impolite or unacceptable, even about the king, in an attempt to get the attention and to entertain. The type of people who would say things that wouldn't be allowed to be said. It's a mixture of clowning, but truth-sayer as well as part of that. The role of jester as truth-sayer can point out things that are wrong, but they are also kind of, you know, allowed to within the norms and the fact that they are a jester. Now, the idea of evil clowns, though, or indeed clowns generally, is interesting. See, the concept of a bad clown and a good clown is a bit more complicated than that. Clowns, by their very nature, are not necessarily good. They're there to entertain. They're funny. They can be the victim, or they can make the victim of you. They wear masks, and they are ambiguous in their nature and outlook. And I think that's one of the reasons why people find them so scary. There are elements such as the Booga dance. Cherokee people of North America, where tribes people would dance together for about half an hour or so. Then a group of up to 10 men wearing masks, representing foreigners, often disfigured through illness or smallpox, arrive. And they come in, they chase round, they act mad. So there's humour as well as menace, but also this kind of reinforcement of a reality that people need to be scared of outsiders. So somewhere deep down embedded in our society, this idea of clowns or jokers or jesters being somehow a bit off is always there. Now that's almost probably entirely due to the fact that people find this kind of entertainment either positive or like an amusing or rejected outright as being quite creepy or frightening. Now, the origins as such as a character in fiction are a bit more vague, shall we say. It pops up infrequently. For example, there's in Edgar Allan Poe's short story Hop Frog, which again kind of mixes not necessarily the nature of clowning, but with the kind of general idea of a jester. It comes from a character with dwarfism who's taken from his homeland and becomes the jester of a king particularly fond of practical jokes. Hopfrog takes revenge on the king and his cabinet for hitting his friend. What he does is he dresses the king and his members as orangutans for a masquerade in front of the king's guests as a joke. However, he murders them, setting fire to their costumes, and they escape. So here we have, you know, a jester who, you know, the clown almost that turns on the audience, the entertainment, and is willing to kill them. That was written in 1849. Of course, since we're in England, we can't fail to miss Punch and Judy, the old seaside resort, entertainment. This end of the pier performance between two puppets is very traditional, but also very violent as well, using shocking, well, it's comedy, domestic violence, apparently, tracing back to the 16th century. And I think a part of the thing is that the actual story of Punch and Judy generally is designed to be something you can dip in and out of. It's designed to be something you can watch for a few minutes, then walk away. And as such, I don't think a lot of people actually consider the typical Punch and Judy performance. And so our minds focus on the most shocking elements. In this case, you know, Punch attacking Judy with a stick, maybe hitting a baby, and also attacking the police officer who comes to investigate. Good old family entertainment. I'm sure we can all agree.
Are you ready, boys and girls?
Yeah.
Are you ready, Mr. Punch?
Yeah, yeah.
Here we go, then. That wasn't very nice, Mr. Punch. Sit up there. Now, boys and girls, after that performance, I'm going to go downstairs and have a large gin. I mean, a cup of tea. But first, would you like to see my baby?
Yes.
Where's the baby?
Oh, get the baby. Hang on a minute. I said, would you like to see my baby?
Where's the baby? Where's the baby?
Stop it. I'll get the baby. Bye-bye for now.
Bye, boys.
I'll say goodbye for now.
Bye-bye.
In Pickwick Papers, so that's what, 1836, 37, a clown is described as being drunk when he's off stage, skulking around the lanes and alleys of London. Let's give you a little bit of a quote. His bloated body and shrunken legs, the deformity enhanced by a hundredfold by the fantastic dress, the glassy eyes, contrasting fearfully with the thick white paint with which the face was besmirched, the grotesquely ornated head, trembling with paralysis, the long, skinny hands, rubbed with white chalk, all gave him a hideous and unnatural appearance. I mean, all this is based, obviously, on Joseph Grimaldi, who kind of came up with the traditional clown motif makeup, vivid hair, white paint. Indeed, Dickens actually edited the memoirs of Grimaldi under the pen name of Boz. And more unfriendly people would possibly suggest that the character, the drunken character in Pickwick Papers, is probably based on the performer's son, who became an alcoholic and died after failing to live up to his father's reputation. But this kind of character, this clown who tries to achieve and then fails, and as such becomes worse and worse, and the mask slips, as it were, is a trope that sits through a lot of modern, of this kind of horror, or this kind of storytelling. In horror cinema, we can start off by looking at possibly 1928's The Man Who Laughs, the adaptation of the Victor Hugo book. Now, the thing about The Man Who Laughs from an interesting cultural point of view is that it's a reappraisal as a classic, a gem of German expressionism. Didn't happen for a long time. In fact, it didn't happen probably till the 70s, 80s, in fact. It was always seen as being a bit overly melodramatic. And indeed, it is a romantic melodrama in a classic silent film sense rather than a horror. But because of its striking visuals and its deep German expressionism, it still has that kind of impetus. And it still kind of feels like a film of being quite, you know, terrifying. Its core concept is, nonetheless. Made by Paul Lenny, obviously said an adaptation. It follows, stars Miri Philbin as a blind girl and Conrad Veidt as Gwynplaine. It's famous for this, is Gwynplaine's notorious carnival freak grin. A trope that sits through a lot of the horror that we may discuss, certainly it's for some characters. Indeed, although it is a melodrama, and indeed has action elements, because of this grim overtone that sits through it, it feels far more like a horror film. It has that tone of horror. Set in the 17th century, it's in England and tells the story of King James II, who sentences a political enemy to death in the Iron Maiden, classic gothic horror, and his son is disfigured for permanent rictus grin, so that he will laugh forever at his fool of a father. And this is kind of, this makeup is very striking and very freak show like. Indeed, the only way he can work is as the laughing man in a freak show at a travelling carnival. He's friends with a blind girl, and they love each other, but he feels himself unworthy due to this terrible disfigurement that he has. From there, it becomes a kind of an action adventure where he, you know, Gwynplaine is effectively rediscovered as being the rightful heir, and is suggested to be forced to be married, and then kind of takes control of his life. As I say, the reasons for its infamousness and the reasons on this list almost certainly is due to the fact that the makeup that's involved, a pallid face, black eyes, huge, tight grin, constant. Now, if that rings a bell, obviously it's because it forms the basis for the Joker character in Batman comic books and TV series. That rictus grin, indeed, is a moment that creates a great deal of horror, and I would argue darkened, is one of the key elements that's darkened all of the Batman stories over the recent 30-odd years, 40 years now. A great example of that would be how otherworldly and improper he sometimes feels when he pops up in books. If you take something like 2005's Hush, for example, that comic book features the Joker appearing at a surprising moment in the tale. And it's a genuine shock horror moment, a full pane of him with his grin, even more, you know, bright and wide than normal, staring out towards the horrors that are there. So we have the Man Who Laughs, which kind of, although not about an evil clown, creates even more of this kind of iconography. Now, it isn't surprising that clowns would appear in silent films, certainly early on, because after all, film was effectively toured as a novelty act in these kind of carnivals and circuses. It was designed in the very early days to show things that you wouldn't normally be able to show. So boxing matches that may be banned in a certain state could be shown on a screen so people could still enjoy a little bit of the noble art. There's other things as well, such as, in Britain, very early on, it was used for, slightly more seedy kind of peephole kind of shows. But simply because it's surrounded by that kind of stuff, it does make you feel that it's not that surprising that, it's not that surprising that, you know, considering the fact that these are items that are going to be shown in lots of carnivals and stuff like that, and fairs, that therefore you would kind of notice and you would kind of use those, you know, clowns or acrobats and that kind of thing in that world. In 1924, there's the film He Who Gets Slapped. A very strange movie. A silent melodrama, again, starring Lon Chaney as like this disgraced academic who finds a job in the Big Top and then relives his greatest humiliation every night by having dozens of clowns beat him up in the centre of the ring. And it's a moment of like self-flagellation that becomes kind of an element that, if you're scared of clowns, is horrific, because it's such a bizarre kind of image. And such a violent kind of moment. It feels strange. And of course, you know, when we're talking about Carnival, how could we miss Todd Browning's 1932 film, American Pre-Code horror film, Freaks? Again, a film that kind of found its way later on. A mixture of the Carnival acts and indeed the clowns, the sideshows, the acrobats, the entire overarching kind of society, which is a performance show. And Browning was very keen to kind of reflect that. Its reputation is of exploitation, but Freaks, in many ways, is a celebration of a culture, obviously now long gone, but of people who it very much loves that community. That's a horrible phrase, but that carnival sideshow community rather than freaks. Browning deliberately kind of looks on at things, he offers elements of like slice of life elements of different people who kind of, it dips in and out. Our carnival act characters have general conversations, and they love and they live, they have children. A conjoined twin becomes engaged to somebody. Frances O'Connor shows how she performs everyday activities with her feet instead of her hands and her arms. And it's very much designed to kind of bring out the humanity in these people and show to an audience that may consider them to be otherworldly, that they weren't, that they were just people like you and I. I think that's ultimately what Browning wanted, although obviously he then turned it into a horror film at the end with revenge. But, I think even it's still in a loving way. If we fast forward to the 80s, and that's not to skip a huge, huge chunk of clown lore, because what we really need to bear in mind the fact that although clowns pop in and out of stories and jesters, the Edgar Allan Poe adaptations of Roger Corman, or indeed, Batman. This idea of evil clowns trundles along, but it really kickstarts again in the psyche of America with Gacy. Now, I'm not going to go into an epic story about John Wayne Gacy, apart from to say, he was the official real deal killer clown. A serial killer and rapist who murdered at least 33 teenage boys and young men between 72 and 78 in Illinois. All the murders happening inside his home. So they're either just brought in by force or deception and then were strangled and then buried in the crawl space of the house. So, in many ways that trope of a man who's a clown, who has a deep, dark secret, is encapsulated in reality with Gacy. His killer clown, obviously coming from the fact that he took on charitable services at fundraising events, parades, children parties, and would dress up as Pogo the Clown, a character that he devised himself, which is part of that clownish lore. If you want to talk about something that's going to bring terrible, damage to the clown community, and dressing up as a clown, big fat man dressing up as a clown and then going around killing lads and raping them is probably going to be the thing that sits there. It adds this kind of motif as well as the clown of being a character who would, who can act in a different way. Gacy said he dressed as a clown, performed as part of the Jolly Joker Clown Club Society for the reasons of it made him, feel like he could regress to childhood. Now, the concept of regressing to childhood is an indicator that, to throw off the responsibilities of adulthood, to ignore the elements that are currently happening, to feel safe and secure. Ironic, considering the kind of acts of violence that he was carrying out. Now, Stephen King is probably highlighted as given the killer clown trope its popularity now. But the 80s did already have a number of these kind of tropes popping up every now and again. There's the musical slasher from 1980, Terror on Tour, for example, that kind of mixes a deal of a killer clown and features a pop group called The Clowns, who are like a gruesome stage act, inspired by the Alice Cooper stuff. And that stage act inspires a guy to put on clown makeup and stalk the groupies backstage. It's not a traditional killer clown as such because, it's a guy just dressed up in makeup, but he certainly looks the part. Then you can move on to something, say, like Poltergeist, which obviously has, the merrymaker kind of toy that kind of springs into life and attacks him. Again, this is more of a kind of a ghost story element, but certainly fits in with the the general idea of the normal order a clown is there to entertain, being brought in, and as such, you know, a child's toy attacking the child. Indeed, for the remake, they kind of accentuated the that element of the story to kind of increase that kind of shock. You know, the if I remember rightly, the killer doll clown idea is the biggest selling point. Stephen King's 1986 book, It, a fantastic book, led to a fantastic TV series as well. An alien parasitic monster in a small town that only the kids can solve the mystery of, who attacks, you know, rips a child's arm off in a storm drain, and dresses a clown to entice children to him so he can kill them, but also because clowns are scary. And then lo and behold, after Stephen King's It, we see a sudden rush. Funland in 87, Blood Harvest 87, Out of the Dark in 89, and suddenly we've got murder clowns all over the shop.
Their mothers always told them, never talk to strangers.
What's that music you're playing? Ooh, it makes me hot.
But now, it's their job.
Call me again.
And it's killing them.
Joanne was killed early this morning.
Murdered.
Kevin has been assigned to do a layout on Bone Fantasy Girl.
There was another murder last night.
Where were you last night?
Alone. Where were you?
Is there any way one of these callers could track you girls down?
Hey, Barbara, how you doing?
Stringer, stall him.
Hi, Dave.
What are you doing in my office?
Find anything.
Just show these idiots they got the wrong guy.
I warned you.
The guy's a nut.
You're going too far this time.
It's him.
Somebody help me!
Myers seems to think I'm the one running around killing everybody.
When he gets here, he'll have half the LAPD waiting.
You had an alibi and you blew it.
Was I your next victim?
You killed her!
Karen, who's this?
Out of the Dark.
Now, the idea of unfunny clowns or violent clowns, and, you know, these films at this point are still considered to be, you know, they treat their monsters with a degree of tongue-in-cheek, shall we say. You know, you wouldn't, it's not a scary clown movie as such, but there is a black humour that runs through it. And so, yeah, you get the thrill of the violence. But also, you also get, you know, a tongue-in-cheek, jokey kind of vibe. I mean, Out of the Dark is worth watching just for the absolute cast, including you get Tab Hunter in there, Karen Black, and Divine as well. They are subversive, kind of amusing, tongue-in-cheek tales, influenced more by John Waters, possibly, than by The Man Who Laughs. But Pennywise the Clown from It still kind of sits as the golden boy of all this kind of stuff. Now, It isn't, obviously, it's a film, it's a mini-series from 1990, utilising, you know, trying to cram in a great, an overly long book, in truth. But Pennywise is probably best known, in fact, for Tim Curry's portrayal, rather than the Pennywise that's in the book.
Aren't you going to say hello? Oh, come on, bucko. Don't you want a balloon?
I'm not supposed to take stuff from strangers. My dad said so.
very wise of your dad, Georgie. Very wise indeed. I, Georgie, am Pennywise the Dancing Clown. You are Georgie. So now we know each other. He right?
I guess so. I gotta go.
Go? Without this?
It's my nose!
Exactly. Go on, kiddo. Take it. Oh. You want it, don't you, Georgie? Oh, of course you do. And there's cotton candy and rides and all sorts of surprises down here. And balloons, too. All colors.
Do they float?
Oh, yes. They float, Georgie. They float. And when you're down here with me, you float!
I mean, Pennywise is the literal manifestation of fear into the real world. What are you frightened of? In this case, a clown. A clown who's willing to attack and to kill. So as we come to the end of the 80s, we see a formulation of a monster that is based entirely on violence and popping up, you know, in dark spaces and willing to attack. Pennywise is so ingrained in our psyche that even though the clown makeup, when you ignore the eyes and the mouth, is actually fairly standard. You know, shock of hair, very white face, a frilly outfit. If it was just cleaned up a bit, you probably wouldn't look quite so terrifying. But because of that performance and the way that particular makeup is seen, Pennywise is without doubt has kind of scarred the psyche in terms of that kind of paint and makeup being intrinsically evil in the mind, I would say. Which is ironic because, you know, while, you know, 2 years before Pennywise, we were, you know, for example, we were still making jokes of this stuff. There's Killer Clowns from Outer Space, which is very much playing on the anti-clown kind of vibe that was currently going on. It's colourful, it's warped as a, you know, an alien invasion threat that sits through it. The 1998 remake of Carnival Souls, really a remake in name only, kind of also points to the fact that, you know, clowns are effectively evil. And now we go to modern day. There's some small notable elements. Rob Zombie's obsession with the scary clown motif is indeed an obsession that he has with pretty much all tarnished kind of Americana. So Captain Spaulding is an over-the-top monster who swears and drinks and screws and is a force of nature. It's Sid Haig, peak Sid Haig, shouting his way through it. In House of Thousand Corpses, it's played like pantomime. In Devil's Rejects, its sequel, it's kind of at least toned down to an extent, but it's very much designed for the exact reasons why you always have that kind of, you know, it's designed to be an element of a garish theme park ride. And then in America, released this year, made a couple of years ago, the Eli Roth produced clown movie takes the concept that no one would actually want to be an evil clown and kind of adds a demonic twist as a man is forcibly changed into a monster. I mean, you know, John Watts is going on to make the new Spider-Man movie. To give you some kind of idea exactly where he's going, but he's created a kind of frightening violent world. It's true horror is the idea that, you know, your father is becoming something he's not. So it feeds into those kind of domestic violence motifs and elements as part of its storytelling. You know, he is lost to the clown makeup in the same way, you know, a man could be lost to gambling or alcoholism. It kind of plays on those kind of tropes of a family kind of spiraling out of control. This fear of clowns is it's called coulrophobia. Now, coulrophobia is effectively is not listed as a psychiatric disorder. So let's get that out the way first. But this concept of exaggerated facial features, big hands, big noses, big feet, that in itself can kind of indicate that these are monstrous deformities. And then we end up kind of people feeling there's an element of the uncanny, the unreal. A clown wears a mask, which can, has as part of those accentuated faces, either a literal one or a painted face. These kind of concepts, or the concept of, you know, a Joker kind of scarring or change, can make people frightened. Also, the additional factor is the fact that the clown behaviour is, by its very nature, antisocial. They are somebody who sprays you with water, that falls over, that smashes stuff. That breaking of the order can make people feel uncomfortable, distrustful. And that kind of distrust can make them frightful and fearful as well. You know, Insane Clown Posse, who I am not going to play a single second of here today, use this kind of trope to make themselves more fearful, despite the fact that they are, you know, mere rappers. In 2006, this fear became apparent for the organisers of Bestival, who cancelled its planned clown theme for the festival when people contacted them and said they wouldn't be able to attend if everyone was dressed as clowns, because that would not be good for them mentally. This all feels a bit harsh. There's two outsides to it. In the University of Sheffield, they polled 250 children to ask about the decor of a hospital to kind of relax them and see how they felt about stuff. A number said they disliked clowns as part of the hospital decor. Many of them, including older children, stated that they actually feared them and that it would not be something that they would enjoy as part of the decor. However, other studies play down that role and say and show out that for people who enjoy clowning, it's actually therapeutic and therefore can lead to healing in children with respiratory illnesses as it calms their breathing. Now, of course, we're into real day and real in true life times, and this idea of clown sightings isn't actually that uncommon. I know at the moment there's a huge deal about it, but the reality is we've already had these kind of stories before. Phantom clowns are a thing, for example. An urban legend, evil clown spottings that pop up. First reported in 1981 in Massachusetts. Children said that a man dressed up as a clown had attempted to lure them into a van. This led to a panic throughout the US and the Midwest and Northeast. It surfaced again in 85 in Phoenix in Arizona. And in 1991 in West Orange, New Jersey. And then again in 95 in Honduras. And 2008 in Illinois, all again about a man, a van, dressed as a clown, come in, have some, you know, do you want some candy kind of stuff. From a cultural point of view, and it feeds into two primal fears. One is obviously the clown motif, and the other one is, you know, a Pied Piper of Hamelin, a trickster. Somebody with subversive or evil ideas who will lead your children away.
Samina.
Well, yeah, families in this neighborhood along East 29th Street are terrified tonight after a clown reportedly appeared inside these woods, offering kids treats to lure them inside. Police got the call around 8:30 last night. The clown reportedly seen by two children and heard but not seen by at least one adult. The clown taking off when police got here. Police say they searched the area here on East 29th Street as well as a neighborhood on Hope Lane, where a second report of a clown came in some 4 hours later, just after midnight. So far, the clown or clowns haven't been caught. We spoke to the woman who says she called police after the first sighting.
These kids were so terrified that this man actually tried to lure them in the woods. Man or woman, we don't know. But, you know, it's somebody in these woods that's trying to get these kids. I was scared and mad at the same time. You know, I wanted to get them myself.
I have a 4-year-old granddaughter that I'm raising, and she loves candy. She loves clowns. She loves all colorful things. So if that would have been her going in there and I wouldn't have been able to find my baby, that's heartbreaking for a child, for a parent to lose their child. I've lost one. I don't plan on losing another one.
This clown, literally, this clown needs to be caught.
Well, Winston-Salem police say they are taking the matter very seriously with plans to step up patrols here along East 29th Street. Now, witnesses describe that clown as wearing white overalls and white gloves, a red nose, red shoes, and had red bushy hair. Reporting live in Winston-Salem, I'm Samina Engel, WXII 12 News.
Now, no adult or police officer have ever seen any of these clowns in this. Although now we kind of shifted on a step. And things are very different, most probably because of films like Clown, the American Horror Story Freak Show, again, utilising that The Man Who Laughs face mask for their particular evil clown motif. And of course, in 1990, the murder of Marlene Warren in Florida, a woman opens a door to a brown-eyed clown bearing flowers and balloons, who rather than gives her flowers and balloons, shoots her in the face and then drives away in a Chrysler. A murder not being solved today, till this day. And now groups like the Clowns of America International are stuck and kind of desperately trying to always kind of say that things are alright. So the Clowns of America, you know, they attack this concept of evilness and kind of say it's damaging for their jobs and their career. Particularly in terms of the, you know, Twisty, an American Horror Story. But all that stuff was nothing in comparison to what's kicked on recently. This evil clown kind of appearance act has took on new, more deviant feelings. In 2013, in the town of Northampton, the Northampton clown appeared and kind of terrorised, kind of didn't. The work was actually of three local filmmakers, Alex Powell, Elliot Simpson, and Luke Urbanski. It looks a bit like Pennywise from It. And then rumours started firing that that it had a knife, when in fact it didn't. Indeed, all it did was kind of walk around, be shot with balloons, and then on pictures and video, and then upload them to social media to kind of create its own legend-making. In 2014, Matteo Moroni from Perugia in Italy began dressing up as a killer clown and terrifying suspected passersby for the hits and the lols and got millions of views. By this point, the phenomenon, due to news reports, had moved over to the US. Looking a bit like Pennywise, the Wasco clown was in fact part of a photography project by an artist. And Wasco himself was designed to be fun, a bit of a laugh. However, the uncanniness unnerved people. However, from there, people took the idea and ran with it. And copycats started appearing, in some cases carrying weapons. Clown sightings start again in 2015. And by 2016, we've got a situation where, again, the classic story of a clown luring a child becomes shows its face. And then, hothoused in social media, we see an increasing number of clown sightings. So this South Carolina boy turns around and says to his mother and says, "A clown tried to lure me into the woods." And from there, then, there's just this avalanche of clowns. And after all, you know, why would you want to play Pokemon Go when a group of students from Pennsylvania State University surrounded the campus street and carried out a mass clown hunt? Connecticut School District banned clown costumes and stating that they were effectively being morphed into a symbol of terror. And this concept of an armed clown hoax
meant that a Massachusetts college was put on lockdown. Now, regardless of whether these children were actually, it was a hoax for one, but you've got to take, regardless of whether they're dressed as a clown or Batman or Bambi, you can't not take that into consideration if somebody's running around a campus supposedly with a knife. So we've had a reaction which basically points out to a summer-based mass hysteria. People don't generally tend to dress up as evil clowns and go haunting schools when they're in the autumn and winter time. Although, to be fair, maybe they should dress up as evil Santas next. For me, I think it's really interesting. I think, people are genuinely they create these horrors for themselves and tell their own stories. I mean, why would you dress up as a clown to try and frighten people? Well, possibly for attention, but also to create something real that is fictional. A clown costume costs, 20, 30 pounds? And can be used to sculpt horror narratives that you're in control of, and therefore you will feel safe, whereas other people do not. It's a prank, though, a childish one at that. However, I still think that at its core, there's a real desire to enjoy monstrousness.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
You see that?
Something different.
It's no shooting star.
Why here? Why now? Why clowns? They've been knocking them dead all over the universe.
What are you gonna do? Knock my block off?
Soon they'll be doing it at a theater near you.
Killer clowns from outer space.
Pizza.
Maybe they're just cruising through the galaxy and stopped here for a bite to eat.
You don't need a police, pal. You need a psychiatrist. They want to play games? They're messing with the wrong guy.
What are you in for?
Killer clowns from outer space. It's crazy.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks very much for listening. What we're going to do now is, if you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is thelasthorrorpodcast@gmail.com. I'm available on Twitter at @orange_monkey, or you can go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com. There is, all our podcasts and a little bit of writing. And also, if you want to click on mixtapes, I send out a weekly listing. Email Spotify playlist of horror related stuff. I very much enjoyed putting together the synth one, so we're going to do one more synth soundtrack this week, and then we are going to move on to something else next week. Okay, so that was very much a a whistle stop tour of one particular motif in horror and in society. Next week we're going to talk about something intrinsically English. I think you find public information films aren't an English phenomenon, obviously they're not, but there was a period of time in the 70s and early 80s where public information films have a very particular feel and tone in Britain. I want to explore that with you and share my thoughts and play you some of that terrifying horror designed to scare the kids straight, as it were. So until then, take care, and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.